Because you listen to this show, I'm going to assume that, like me, you're a person who's fascinated by scientific and philosophical questions. So I wanted to tell you about another show I've discovered recently, the addictive, eye-opening, mind-bending podcast series, The End of the World with Josh Clark. Josh Clark is co-host of the absorbing Stuff You Should Know podcast. And for The End of the World, he dives into existential risks, ways we humans might accidentally wipe ourselves out with the same technology we're developing now in the hope that it will make a bright future for us. For example, how a haphazard physics experiment could end the universe, or why artificial intelligence could take control of the world, or how an artificially mutated virus could escape a lab and create a global pandemic. This is serious stuff for sure, but The End of the World delivers the fascinating science behind existential risks through an immersive experience with a beautiful original score and cinematic sound design that takes you from a spacecraft trying to navigate interstellar space to deep inside your body to the far future where humans have evolved into a post-biological species who live in digital form. The End of the World with Josh Clark is waiting to take you on an adventure. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts. Why not listen to all 10 episodes now and join the conversation on social media with hashtag EOTWJoshClark. Welcome to Future Makers, your invitation to cutting-edge debates on our changing society with leading researchers at the University of Oxford, recorded here in the Thomas Hobbes Room at Hertford College. I'm Peter Millikan, Professor of Philosophy, and our first series is all about artificial intelligence. As chatbots and virtual assistants become an ever-present part of our world, and algorithms increasingly support decision-making, people working in this field are asking questions about the bias and balance of power in AI. With the makeup of teams designing technology still far from diverse, is this being reflected in how we humanize technology? Who are the people behind the design of algorithms? And are they reinforcing society's prejudices through the systems they create? With me to discuss this today are Gina Neff, Senior Research Fellow and Associate Professor at the Oxford Internet Institute, Carissa Veliz, Research Fellow at the Yohiro Center for Practical Ethics and the Wellcome Center for Ethics and Humanities, and Sean Brook, a DPhil student at the Oxford Internet Institute, focusing on the construction of gendered identity on the pseudonymous web. Welcome to you all, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gina, would you like to start by telling us about your recent research findings?
I've been looking at the question, does AI have gender? And at first, that seems like an obvious answer, because when we think of technologies, we don't think of them as having human identifiable characteristics. And yet, what we see with artificial intelligence is there's been an enormous push to personalize these technologies into our everyday life. So as they become into part of our domestic lives, smart speakers in our homes, voice assistants on our smartphones, we're starting to see certain codes and practices that turn these technologies into gender performances. Now, that may sound a little theoretical, but when we hear Alexa giving us assistance, we're hearing a female, feminine voice performing a role that's been classified as gendered, as female. But in a study of financial and legal assistance, artificial intelligence assistance, it was found that those personifications of AI tended to be male, that we're calling authority and expertise in terms of masculine names, masculine avatars, and assistance and help as feminine. I think the bigger issue isn't the sound of the voices or the names of the technologies, how we call them, but rather, are we building technological systems that create structures of voice and authority that will destabilize what happens within a broader society? And that's where I think that we need to start raising serious questions now.
Could you spell out a bit more what you mean by destabilizing? Because some people might say, well, actually, if these choices are reinforcing existing stereotypes, then actually they're helping to maintain society rather than destabilize it.
So we have an amazing opportunity to think about how new artificial intelligence technologies expand our capacities to act in organizations, in government, in schooling. And are they coming at the cost and expense of real people working in organizations? One of the studies that has recently come out looked at caseworkers in social services in the United States and found how when a large technology company brought in a database system, the power of individual caseworkers, many of whom were women, to make authoritative choices was diminished because people deferred to the technology. Now, as a sociologist of technology, I'm really interested in seeing what's going to happen as we have widespread adoption of AI in organizational settings. Are we going to see workplaces where individual workers with years of knowledge and expertise in the front lines of decision making, are we going to see their power and authority amplified with the rise of these systems, or are we going to see challenges to their ways of knowing? I'm afraid that if we don't make interventions now, we're going to begin to see that women are going to lose out in workplaces as AI becomes more prevalent.
I can imagine that if you are in any role that involves decision making and an AI system is brought in to help you make the decision, there is a risk that as the AI system becomes more sophisticated, as you can see that it's taking the various things into account that it ought to, you might end up deferring to it, maybe from laziness, maybe from just feeling that you don't have the confidence to challenge what it comes out with. Are you saying that there is a big asymmetry between the way that men and women react in that situation?
We have two challenges. The first is we have AI systems that are being talked about in popular culture as having superhuman powers. It's not so much that I think men and women respond to the results of AI in different ways, although that's an empirical question. We need to know the answer to that, and we don't yet. But rather, what we see is that the ability to push back, query, and challenge the results of a technological system may be unlike any technological system that we've had before in place, that people may feel that they don't have the power and authority to raise those questions. So yes, that may be gendered, but I actually think the practice of being able to resist. Take, for example, recently Reuters reported that Amazon had tried to put in place an AI-enabled hiring system, and hiring is one of the systems that we know where there's enormous possibility for computational parsing of CVs. And yet, without clear instruction from the programmers, the system learned very quickly to de-emphasize people who had items on their resume that referred to being in women's groups and women's organizations. So being on the women's rugby team, for example, would cause a resume to be parsed out as not one of the successful ones. The reason? Amazon was building its system based on past performances. They built the system based on who had been successful in hiring, and they knew they had a problem in hiring for gender parity at their organization. And yet, small differences in the data end up amplifying in the larger structural system.
So this is bias in the machine learning. Basically, it's got a biased pool from which it's drawing its information, and therefore the algorithm that results simply reflects that bias.
If we're building systems based on an assumption of neutrality and objectivity, then when the technology is deployed in society, we're going to have systems of bias and discrimination.
And do you think this is connected with the issue you raised at the beginning about gendered voices of different systems, or is this a quite separate point, do you think?
The second challenge, I think, is are we reinforcing notions that women are not authoritative and strong voices within organizations and that they don't represent the voice of expertise. So while it may be easy for adults to dismiss Alexa as a voice of reason, a recent survey of American consumers found only 8% could name a woman working in technology. And of that 8%, when they were pushed, half of those named Alexa or Siri as the woman they knew who worked in technology. Now, I worry what will happen as children grow up hearing that virtual assistants are the women around them designed to be fulfilling our wishes and demands rather than seeing that Marissa Mayer of Yahoo or Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook are the women voices who we actually hear.
It's not only that it's doing damage, it's also a missed opportunity, because if done differently, these systems could help push in a good direction.
Absolutely. As we get more technological assistance systems in our daily lives, what kinds of values are we reproducing? Are we creating systems that enable us to see possibility and opportunity and expansion of human capacity? Or are we seeing them as systems of superhuman ability that we could never live up to?
Carissa.
It is very tempting to think of technology as something neutral, as something that doesn't have values, or that it only has values that are rather technical, like efficiency, for example. AI systems are not only learning how to do a particular task, but they're also learning about our preferences. And our preferences so far have been very biased towards men. So it's not that the AI taught itself that male candidates were better, it's rather that the AI picked up on our preference. So one of the problems is that if AI work on the basis of data that's already there, the data will be biased with different social biases and prejudices that have been there for a very long time. And it's a very tall order to create the kind of data that will not be biased. And so it's very important rather to use data that we have, but also to steer it in a way that actually responds to our values and not to past performance or past norms.
Part of the problem, I take it, is that with a machine learning algorithm, it's incredibly difficult to understand how it's doing what it's doing. It's a sort of black box, and you get the past data, feed it in, and out come the judgments, which, as you say, reflect the bias that's already there in the data. What would you advocate doing about this? How do you stop that?
Something that's fundamental is to come up with auditing systems that can identify prejudices. Thanks to sociologists like Gina, we are very familiar with the kind of prejudices we are vulnerable to. It is not impossible to design systems that identify those. But another thing that I think is very important and somewhat missing is to think more about ethics. So lately we've heard a lot about regulation with the GDPR and other initiatives, and regulation is fundamental, super important, and we can't do without it. But legislation has a lot of limits. So one is that it's very slow and it's always catching up. It's more about fixing problems that are already there rather than preventing new problems. And it's very clunky. It's not easy to change. I think we need to look to other disciplines and how they have managed to tackle some challenges. So for example, in the 1960s, there weren't any ethics committees in any hospital. Doctors were faced with very difficult ethical problems for which they weren't trained, and they had enough on their plates trying to save lives. And that's how bioethics developed in the 1970s. It only took a couple of decades, and now you cannot find a hospital without an ethics committee. So I think digital ethics would do well in looking to bioethics as a success story and looking to how that happened. And I think there are three things that are very important. One thing would be the development of ethics codes, like, for example, the Belmont Report or the Declaration of Helsinki, these kind of codes that are drafted by very legitimate organizations that have inclusive committees with people who are experts and take into account all stakeholders. A second thing related to ethics code is to have professional codes. So, for example, if you're a doctor, you may do something that's not illegal, like, for example, date a patient, but that's so unethical that you can lose your license and your job. And similarly, people think that ethics or an ethics code would not have teeth, But there are ways around it in which ethics could have a real impact. Just like every hospital has an ethics committee, every technology company, every programmer should have an ethics committee to which they could ask questions and check their algorithms with and be able to audit whatever they are programming. And third, I think it's very important to respect autonomy. Gradually, with the development of bioethics, we have seen that medicine is more and more sensitive to what people want. Technology today isn't very respectful of autonomy. Users are not being asked, what do you want, what do you need, and what are your values in your life? What will make you live better and have more well-being? Technology companies are imposing on us their values and their needs and their economic interests.
One obvious difference between the technology case and the medical case, I imagine, is that in medicine, usually, it's clear when a big decision has to be made. I'm suffering from something and there's a question of what treatment I should have. That's a big decision. If research is being done in a hospital, you go to the ethics committee and so forth. With AI, it's not quite like that. We're using it all the time for lots of little things. So the user may not be aware that there's a big decision here. The operation of what's going on behind the system may be completely opaque to them. On the business of people's values, I imagine a lot of people in technology would say, well, of course people express their values. They do that through the market. They decide which software they want to buy, which software they want to use. Of course we are going with users' values. We're paying a lot of attention to those. When we do our marketing, our design, we're all the time pandering to what the consumer wants. What's wrong with that?
You're right. There is a disanalogy in the way medical decisions are made and technology decisions are made. I think that the important technical and technological decisions are made when things are programmed and let out into the world. And that's when stakeholders should be taken into account. Users should be asked, what kind of app would you like? What kind of app would make your life better? Secondly, the presence of an ethics committee should be important for everyone involved, the business person who's thinking about earning their keep, the programmers who are worried about making a product that will be helpful and make the world a better place, and the clients who are using that program. So I wish I could go to Apple's ethics committees and say, hey, I'm having this problem with this app. It's really bugging me. What can we do about it? Or this happened to me, and can there be a consultation as to whether I am owed something, some kind of compensation, or whether there can be some kind of negotiation? Of course, different people have different values. And what that signals is that technology should be more flexible. It shouldn't impose one value, but it should give people options. And that's something that we're seeing with privacy. There's a very clear tendency towards more options. So part of what the GDPR is asking for businesses to do is to give people options. Do you want to add more of your privacy in return for more services? Or are you happy with less services just so that you can protect your privacy? And I think that's very important. The market is one way in which we can know what people want, but the market gets distorted in all sorts of ways. So one way it gets distorted is when people create persuasive technology that really appeals to our most fundamental impulses and that sort of block our autonomy. So when apps create these kind of gamification systems to make you click on them as much as possible and engage as much as possible to the detriment maybe of your family relationships, your work, and your general well-being, that is distorting the market in some way. When there's a monopoly and suddenly business like Facebook or Google becomes so dominant that it's almost inescapable, then the argument that you are choosing to use them, it becomes quite questionable. Yes, I have a choice, but it's an unfair choice. It's like when a robber comes to you, puts a gun to your head and says, your money or your life. Of course, that's a choice, but that's not a choice you should need to make.
Sean, let's come to you.
Well, I think that companies that can include ethics and fairness and looking at the biases in their data sets are the ones that are going to be likely to succeed. So in the last month or two, IBM have developed software that looks for biases in data sets and can, in fact, neutralize biases in data sets that we use to teach machine learning algorithms. Because fundamentally, when we're talking about AI in the context in which I understand it, we're talking about how we can make predictions from data that we feed into a machine. One of the more well-known and colloquial examples of how having unbiased data sets can be bad for a company is Microsoft's Tay, AI that was put on Twitter that then was meant to be able to interact and tweet and learn from what people tweeted at it or her and then tweet back. And it was an absolute nightmare for Microsoft. I think it lasted 16 hours before it was taken off, because the information that the bot was provided with led it to spew out quite racist and sexist information. The bot was targeted by a group of people colloquially known as trolls from a site called 4chan, which is about 70% male and is quite known for doing these sort of like gender-based hate attacks, and specifically on Twitter. And so then this barrage of hatred led the bot to then start tweeting out swastikas and very sort of offensive rhetorics, and had to be taken down 16 hours after its release. And that's an absolute nightmare for something like Microsoft. So if you could have this incorporation of something against harassment in these spaces, because if you're a woman online, or you are aware of how women interact online, harassment or people speaking out against you or silencing your opinion is something that is so normalized that these male-dominated design teams, when they create something like Tay, they put it out on the internet and they don't really consider that sort of situatedness and the lived experience of being a woman in a space and the anonymity and how that can lead to very certain treatment can be quite problematic. So the inclusion of, say, more diverse teams and the ideas against like harassment and awareness of these spaces, because I think, as we alluded to before, that AI can be this social mirror, and sometimes we don't like quite what stares back, because we get the computational power of AI means that any differences are radicalized and we see them a lot more apparently. So when I was looking at the way that people reacted to Tay and the way that people discussed how the entity itself was provided with this information and how there were no checks in place so that it couldn't get like this sexist and racist rhetorics, was the quote that if you don't stand for something, then you'll fall for anything. If you don't have these barriers in place and have this acknowledgement of these tropes and these ways that people interact online and offline, then you'll end up just mimicking the best and worst of humanity.
You started off, I think, suggesting that, as it were, the market can play a role here. If people actually know the ways in which software is biased, they will choose to go for software that doesn't incorporate those biases.
I think that generally when it comes to the individual basis of a consumer, that people will largely pick a path of least resistance. And so there is a prerogative of ethics committees and the involvement of experts to an extent where there's an equal opportunity of AI there. I think that we shouldn't default to including biases and rather should go towards creating something that's more neutral.
An important point, and again, something that relates to medicine, is that your doctor will give you many options, whether you want surgery, whether you want meds, whether you don't want any kind of treatment. But all those options respect your autonomy and are acceptable in some sense. So even if you give consent, it's not okay for your doctor to torture you for fun, right? So there are certain options that are not in the menu. We should do that with technology. Of course, we should give people options to explore and express their values. But there are certain options, like not hiring women because they're women, that just shouldn't be on the menu for AI.
If we take a concrete example, we can see how hard it is to present people with options, but how tragic it is that technology companies don't even try. So, for example, Google. It's a technology most of us use every single day. And yet, the values built into Google are about search efficiency. And there's values in search I don't understand, and I'm a professor of the internet. But that said, Sophia Noble in Algorithms of Oppression has written about how challenging it is if you're a young Black girl using Google, where search might return horrible, racist, highly sexualized information about the phrase Black girls. And yet we don't have and are never really given the option to say we want our search to prioritize certain kinds of information over others. Now, you know, this is a talk about AI and AI and gender. You know, Sean's work is looking really much about how women experience the internet and how these spaces are presented to women as if they are the exception rather than the norm. I think if we think concretely about the technological spaces in which we all inhabit every day, we start to see these places where we're contorting and shaping our own use and practices around the values we want to exercise, rather than being offered the opportunity to say what we do is normal and what we do is the way we want to experience our technological environments.
To some extent, what we do with Google does shape, doesn't it, what we see. I mean, that is, records are kept of previous searches. It's a common complaint about some of the software we use that it biases things towards our own prejudices. This is often seen as a problem for those technologies rather than an advantage that they're able to configure them. You weren't saying we ought to go for objective neutrality. You were saying we ought to be able to configure things to our choices.
Right now, we can't even understand the set of values that are being exercised upon us. Facebook prioritizes, for example, certain sets of values, and most users are not clear about what those values are. We know information on social media travels further and faster if it's scandalous, salacious, wrong information even. We know since the U.S. presidential elections in 2016 that the amount of junk news circulating in social media has actually increased despite the efforts of technology companies to do something about it. And we know that users who actually search and seek out information are actually better informed, and the idea of an echo chamber is probably overstated. And yet, we have algorithmic systems that play out in our daily lives that most users are not clear about how they work or why and what they can do about them. I worry as these systems become more pervasive and part of many more different kinds of aspects of our everyday life, that we're going to start to see them as being superhuman, all-powerful, inevitable, as we talk about AI right now. And that's what I think is one of the most dangerous stakes that is at play in thinking about the future of AI.
Well, it's true that we have some input into how technology works, and we mold it to a certain extent with our patterns of search and our patterns of behavior. The way it molds us is just as strong and in very particular ways that people might not be aware of. So imagine that Google would give you the option, would say, hey, our algorithm has noticed that you are left-wing. Do you want to see only left-wing information, or do you want to see both? That would be one way to make it transparent as to how these algorithms are molding searches and people. There was an interesting article in the New York Times in March about how YouTube is radicalizing people. And this journalist realized that when she looks up for a video, the next video that gets recommended is more extreme than the past one. So if she looks up a left-wing video, say about Hillary Clinton, every recommendation, every next video that comes up is more radical than the last one. It's on the same side of politics, but more radical. And so yes, you are influencing how that algorithm works, but it is influencing you in that it's taking you to more and more extreme versions of what you first searched for. One important way to think about these issues is for programmers to think that when they design an app, or they design an algorithm, or they design a robot, they're also designing the user that's going to use it. So what kind of users do we want to design? What kind of people do we want to engage? And we're also designing the kind of society we're going to live in.
I think when we're thinking about the way that technology is created and who creates it, it's so important to look just beyond once it's been rolled out, then putting the checks in there, but think about who is the they who is creating the robot, because that has consequences in the power and the social relations that are inscribed into a technology from pre its inception, from the purposes that we think and apply technology to. One aspect of Gina's work that she's highlighted is how femininity can be embodied in robots, in the way that a voice is a form of embodiment, but also physically in robots. So there's plenty of examples in fiction since the 1920s when we thought about AI as being female. If we think about films like Her and Ex Machina, they often portray AI as a female entity, an object of affection in Her, or something to be locked in a basement in Ex Machina. In countries like Saudi Arabia, you have Sophia, a humanized robot who has been granted citizenship in a country where women have to have a male guardian to make financial or legal decisions. Yet a female robot can be a citizen there. And so I think it's very important to consider the makeup of these design teams and how if we had a group of more people working together, like is becoming so important in different types of technology. So say like agile software development is an element where we think about a lot more collaborative teams. And if when these collaborative frameworks that are right at the edge of technology, if we can put women there, because we have this idea that female is the future, but what if female is the future only in the voices that the men are creating and not the women creating the technology itself?
Another concrete example comes from Google Translate. Now, I love Google Translate. And I'm not expert in Hungarian, but Hungarian is one of those languages that doesn't have gendered pronouns. So if you want to say something about he or she, you use the third person, but you use a gender neutral term. So if I were to say of Sean, she is a scientist, I would say egy tudós in Hungarian. I apologize to all the Hungarian speakers out there for my terrible Hungarian. I did this recently at the Royal Institution. I took a list of 20 simple job titles in Hungarian, as you would say, that person is, with the name of the title, and translated them live in front of an audience into English. 18 out of the 20 came back, he is. He is a composer. He is a musician. He is a cook. He is a chef. He is an executive chef. He is an RFID developer. The two job titles that came back as feminine, she is a childminder and she is a baker. It's devastating. And yet, this is a robust finding that a team in Brazil have found across 17 different languages. Now, I don't think that Google are trying deliberately to erase women out of job titles and job categories. But here we have something that's really powerful in the representation of women in everyday life. If you don't know this bit of context about Hungarian already, then you ascribe some certainty to what this translation is telling you that simply isn't there when you see a gendered pronoun in English.
Gina, we've heard Carissa say that she would favour ethics committees supervising all the AI companies in what they produce. Would you go that way too, or do you have some other proposal?
I think this is a great idea, and I certainly think it's something that companies and tech companies need to take forward as a first step. But we actually have to build an organizational approach to ethics that goes beyond individual decision making. So I'm very concerned about how we're building ethical organizations. Are we building organizations that people are going to be able to give feedback, criticism, and stopgap measures when they see, for lack of a better term, runaway AI? When someone sees a problem in place, are they going to be able to stop it? I thought about this recently on a problem that I saw on a construction site. So I spent 8 years studying large-scale building construction. And someone working, wearing a hard hat, working in the field, saw a problem about to happen. And yet it took so many layers of bureaucracy to get through to the decision makers that it was easier for him to take the path of least resistance and do nothing. I'm afraid that in many of our organizations, we've built something that it's hard to act individually ethically, and we need to think ethics from the top. So not only ethics committees, but making sure that leaders understand the absolute importance of transparency and accountability in the organizational, social, and technological systems that they're building.
I don't think that ethics committees are going to be a panacea and fix everything and everything's going to be fine. Of course not. But they're a very important part of the solution. And I think if you look to hospitals and medicine again, ethics committees have worked as a mediator. So when a patient has a problem or a doctor has a problem or a nurse has a problem, they can go to the ethics committee and they can be the mediators between the different stakeholders. Likewise, ethics committees in the hospitals have liaisons to other ethics committees in other hospitals, but also to ethics committees at the state level, national level, international level, and there can be communication between them.
Are you going to impose whatever structures you put in place by law? Is that how you're going to motivate the companies to do these things? Gina, will you put ethics in there by fiat or?
We need more regulation. That's clear. This is a wild west of regulatory landscape, and we absolutely need better and more proactive policymaking in the field of AI. And in this country, there is a significant push to make that happen. However, there are other kinds of mechanisms and frameworks that are starting to emerge. So, for example, companies are signing on to the Partnership on AI, which our department is a member as well, to create that third space where government, industry, and academia can sit together and think through what those approaches would be. That's not the regulatory stick, but it's certainly one of the carrots that we have in our toolkit.
On the regulation side, can you give an example of the sorts of regulation that you think would be desirable here? Because one notorious problem with ethics is it's often very difficult to pin down rules that will tell you, you know, what's appropriate and what isn't.
I think the frameworks are emerging in terms of what is going to work for policymaking in AI. We know we need better oversight in AI-enabled decision-making and a whole host of areas. So, for instance, in legal sentencing, the state of California has just put forward that counties, courts need to use AI-based systems for sentencing. And researchers know these systems, as they stand now, are deeply flawed. So groups are working from technology to inform policymakers that this choice that looks like they're eliminating bias is actually going to amplify it in different ways. Take, for example, fake news, junk news, and misinformation. We know that misinformation is circulating on social media at differential capacities across different countries. That's not an AI regulation policy. That's a media landscape policy. That's media regulation that's in place. So we know that in Germany, we're seeing less misinformation circulate than we see in the UK or the US. And so there are ways to think about policymaking for AI that isn't necessarily about regulating the individual algorithm, but it's about recognizing that the technological quick fixes aren't going to be that.
Right. Okay. If you're bringing in more regulation, the obvious complaint will be that that's going to stifle innovation, that the small company with the brilliant idea isn't going to be able to implement that brilliant idea because it gets bogged down in having to get committees and all the rest. Yeah, Sian.
Regulation is one of the approaches that needs to be taken with a more inclusive base of who develops it. They need to work hand in hand, because if we have regulation that then allows for AI and machine learning to then be more open to people, then we're opening up the people who can help develop it. If we only have 10% of women, say, participating in machine learning or in computer science, then we're actually cutting off such a vast proportion of like development and like intellectual resources and potential intelligence in the development. And by opening up computer science and having hand in hand a level of sort of soft regulation with grassroots movements that are encouraging people to develop AI beyond sort of boys and their toys, then you open up the people who can develop it, the people who have the intelligence, and the people who may revolutionize it. Like, because we have these basis of stereotypes and the idea of who we think can be developing in computers, well, that's very counterproductive to fostering innovation and development in computing, to cut so many people off.
It certainly limits the direction that innovation can take, but we'd all sign up to wanting more women to go into computing education. We at Oxford put a lot of effort actually into trying to encourage exactly that. But that's a long-term aim. What about the company that's producing the software that they hope is going to become the next big thing next year? Are you suggesting that they should be regulated, that they should have to take their product through ethics committees or whatever before they're allowed to release it in the wild? or are you going to prohibit people from buying and using it?
Think about research. Does ethical committees limit research? To a certain extent, yes. But we haven't seen a huge amount of limits since we have research committees in universities. And even independent researchers can create research.
But isn't there a big difference there that within a university or a hospital, research is a big operation, whereas some of the big technologies that we see have literally been produced by, you know, one or two people? Gina?
I think this is a great point, that in small companies, there are often not the capacity to be asking the social and ethical questions about the impact of what's being built. In fact, those developing the tools have their hands full. So in some regard, it is up to many of us to be involved in developing frameworks and best practices that can create a usable toolkit that smaller-based developers can use and that actually push the industry for better practices. So I think, yes, the ethical committees, the ethics committees within large organizations is absolutely something we should be pushing for. How we create something that looks like an industrial level approach, individual professional codes of conduct, but also resources that those involved in building can actually build on and get advice from.
Let's suppose I produce some software. I hope this is going to be the next big thing. I go to your tools and I'm able to check out that my software doesn't incorporate undesirable biases and things. Is that the sort of thing you have in mind?
Absolutely. And these kinds of frameworks, these kinds of codes are beginning to be developed by different groups. Simply asking, what are the possible unintended consequences of this tool or technology that I'm doing? If developers could go through a simple practice of thinking about how their development could be used for harm, they can go a long way to both mitigating potential harms, but also developing a better product that addresses needs and creates good rather than something that potentially could be a public relations nightmare.
Presumably, if you make consumers aware of these tools and the possibility of using them, they can put pressure on the creators of the software to actually conform their practice to these things.
If we at the University of Oxford, with our expertise in computing and philosophy, came up with a code of conduct that we could attach a best practices stamp, I'm sure the royalties on this could fund doctoral education for the next 1,000 years.
Gina's response is exactly right. We need, on the one hand, to have ethics codes that people can refer to. And I think these have to be drafted by experts around the world and by many organizations. And one example that is very helpful now is Shannon Valor has this document online about an introduction of digital ethics to digital ethics. And essentially, it's a bit of a checklist, richer than that, but it includes a checklist of the kinds of questions that programmers should be asking themselves to make sure that they can come up with the best product they possibly can. And if you're a small business and don't have the resources to have a committee, you can at least have that kind of support so that when you become big, you will be able to have that ethics committee that will support you. But you will have the basis that will make it a lot easier to make sure you have an ethical product from the start. And on the other hand, I think you were gesturing towards is would be amazing. We could have tools, for example, to audit things like making sure that algorithms are not discriminating people, and that people could actually use that and test their algorithms to see whether they are compliant or not.
Mind you, I imagine that developing tools like that would itself be a major research task, wouldn't it?
I can think of very few more valuable tasks to do right now.
Indeed. Sean?
I think that we do have the technological ability that is something that we could do when you have a combination of the tech solution and the social solution. You don't need to necessarily pick one. You can have an ethics code and an awareness. And I think the very existence of these sort of documents and awareness of it is a step in the right direction. We don't have to have nothing or cure it. We don't have to have a binary understanding of ethics and AI. We can have just an idea, okay, well, ethics and AI is now this thing that we need to think about, and the big companies thinking about these and people knowing when things are going wrong is going the right way. And I think a technological solution and a social solution in conjunction is probably the most productive approach.
I can see that there could be a lot of social pressure on companies to conform in that way. And we've talked about some of the steps that might help them in that direction. But another point you raised earlier, Sean, was to do with the composition of the workforce in AI companies and the desirability of getting more diversity in there. I'd be interested to hear from you all about what you think could be done to help that push.
I think there's a wonderful way to increase the number of women and the number of people from diverse backgrounds in technology by expanding our definitions of what it means to be technical. In our department, we don't require strong maths as a background. We don't require an undergraduate degree in computer science, although you can have those. But we do train all of our students in Python. We do train all of our students in statistical logic. We do train all of our students in thinking deeply and carefully about our technological future. And what happens is we end up with incredible, amazing graduates who go on to work at large technology companies, large policy organizations, in government. My own doctoral students are now, having been trained in qualitative and theoretical approaches, are now in lead data science positions in technology startups. And so I think that there are these ways that we can not simply think about the pipeline of who comes in to computing as necessarily just in computer science, and we need to work on that problem, but we can think about broader ways that we can reach people who are interested in our technological future and train them and put them into amazing positions where they can make an impact.
So do I take it you think the combination of the social science and the computer science makes this route more attractive for women?
Well, the research shows that when women are presented computer science as applied to a concrete social problem or outcome, that they're much more likely to find it an appealing career path. It's also easier in some regard to work with the pipeline of women that we have in our program as postgraduates, the pipeline of women that we have coming out and train them starting there. So I am all for expanding the representation of women in computer science. In the United States, in my home country, we've seen the representation of women in computer science go down since the 1980s, from about a third in the 1980s to only 18% of graduates, undergraduate majors in 2017. So we're going backwards, even as we see this expansion in computer science, we're going backwards in the percentage of representation of women. But if we can create more pathways, not just expand the computer science pathway, create more pathways for training women in technical positions, I think we're going to have a better chance at bringing more people to the table in making those good decisions about our technological future.
A necessary condition. Unfortunately, it's not sufficient. So one thing I worry about is that, for example, in the university in Spain, you see the participation of women, when you see it on a graph, it looks like a scissor. So at the beginning, there are more women undergraduates than men. And then as the career goes on, you end up having a lot more men than women. So we need more women to be trained, but we cannot trust that that will be enough for women to actually participate fully in businesses and particularly in high-paying jobs and decision-making jobs. So one thing that I think we should consider is whether we should think about being a woman as a plus in experience, just like having a PhD is a plus and just like having experience in other senses is a plus. Only women can know what it is like to be a woman. And if we are worried about how technology is influencing women, how women are experiencing the internet, and so on and so forth, we need women's input. And that is a plus.
So I, at the Internet Institute, teach courses in Python and R, and there was this quite interesting idea, okay, brought to me by my students, of how women and men code differently, because there's this very incredibly unsubstantiated idea that men code better than women. And when you look at the nuances of what better is, it's because women are stereotypically seen to spend more time making their code more eloquent, more beautiful. They're less prone to interdependencies in how they write their code. There's this idea in cognitive psychology called ambient belonging, and the way that we dress a room we're in attracts and detracts people from there. And this study found that just the very idea of having Star Trek posters and video games in a room significantly detracted women from participating in it, if it was just compared to a room that had none of these stereotypical objects. And this held true even from when the room was populated entirely by women. So 82% of women still would prefer an environment that didn't have these objects associated with masculinity and computer science, even if both scenarios are full of women. So there also needs to be a change in how we view these situations, and we don't just see these spaces as like Star Trek posters, video games, and some very sort of badly timed and lewd jokes, say.
Perhaps early in education, do you think the boys are getting more excited by doing things fast and quick and dirty? And maybe there's a bit of a tension between those.
My particular field site is I study hackers, and the way that ideas of hacking and this very sort of consequentialist, this quick, this very sort of like brutalist sort of idea of code appeals so much more to men stereotypically than it does to women. And that this idea of beauty in the way that women code means that they get a lot more excluded from the cybersecurity elements of computing. And even in anonymous spaces, you see exactly the same representations that you see offline. You only get about 10% of users, say, on Stack Overflow and other anonymous forums where we discuss programming tend to be women. So we see the stereotype continuing with ideas of quick and dirty code, but it also can be in the way that people speak. So a very sort of masculinist rhetoric that's come in my research is going, oh, check the documentation. Oh, you don't know what you're on about. Oh, I know this better than you. And I think the idea that men are a lot more confident and or told that they're knowledge is very certain, and women are left to sort of doubt themselves a little bit more, means that in anonymous spaces and hackers and places where code needs to get the job done, that you end up with more men doing it.
A very wise mentor of mine once said that he felt his main job half the time was teaching his male doctoral students that they're not the next Max Weber. And the other half of the time, it was teaching his female students that they could be. I think Sean's point about hackers and education continues all through the pipeline. We don't simply have a pipeline problem. We know women drop out of computer science at a higher rate than men do. And we know that they drop out of jobs and technology at a higher rate than men do. And so part of the problem that we need to solve is creating the kinds of organizations where women feel like their work is being valued and that they can see that people like them are valued and belong. Creating that sense of ambient belonging, that wonderful study that Sean referred to, was found in how attractive computer science seems to university majors, to women in, as university majors. But we need to take that further and think about what are we coding as our technical spaces? What do we think of as a technology company? And how do sometimes social media companies and social media community managers who are doing incredibly important work around creating the social infrastructure for our technological lives, how that work is often not seen as being tech?
Carissa.
It's very important to make women and men be comfortable in their workplace. And I could imagine that it might be quite challenging to be a woman in a company that is producing something that you take to be quite sexist. Like, for example, a sex robot that mimics resistance, that mimics a rape. I could imagine that not being the perfect kind of workplace for a woman. I don't know if you've heard about this hologram called Gatebox. It's become very popular in Japan. Essentially, it's a hologram. It's like a girl that lives in a little tin, glass tin, and it's supposed to be a companion. And when you see the publicity, there's this lonely man, and suddenly now he's happy because he has this companion waiting for him at home all the time and asking him to come home soon. And that's another kind of product that might make women uncomfortable producing it. One very important question that we should ask ourselves is, why do we gender robots? Why do we gender algorithms and voices? Why do we need it to be gendered? In some cases, it becomes really tricky, like sex robots. Then you can imagine there is a very straightforward reason why they're gendered. But in other cases, like Alexa or other kinds of assistants, why do we need to choose between male and female? If these are not people, these are not gendered beings, why couldn't we make a gender-neutral AI?
Or presumably you can give the user a choice and either choose a male voice and indeed different accents, if you like, or a female voice. Might it be the case that lots and lots of users would choose the female voice for the subservient role and choose the male voice for the one that's giving lawyerly advice, Gina?
There's a wonderful group, Equal AI, co-founded by Rob Locascio, who's the CEO of one of these virtual assistant companies. And he founded this initiative based on watching his small child bark orders at Alexa and wondering, you know, what are we doing when we think about these kind of voices? It's a large social experiment that we haven't really seen the results of yet. So we don't know what is happening. So one of the partners on Equal AI is a longtime researcher in this space, Justine Cassell at Carnegie Mellon. And she's asked some of the most playful questions about voice and robots. So why is it that we're personifying AI as human? Why is it that we're bringing these technologies into our lives, acting as if they are our buddies, our friends, our human companions? They could as well be blobs, shapes, ghosts, aliens, things that we don't need to put our human baggage onto them.
One of the requirements, I think, for ethical AI is that it not be deceptive or manipulative. And there's an argument to make that robots that pretend to be human or want to be human somehow hijack our natural impulses to make us feel a certain way and attach to them in a certain way that is arguably deceptive. So yeah, why don't we think about ways of designing AI that don't have to be personified, that don't have to be human or animal, that are their own thing?
I can still see the objection coming that if you gave people the choice, they would actually prefer the personified version. Unless you're going to legislate to force companies to do things in a particular way, then things are going to be quite slow to change, aren't they?
Well, maybe. I mean, look at Slack, a very popular co-working environment. Slack has a bot, and they simply refer to it as the Slack bot. And they don't assume that you need to have a human avatar in order to have some experience with seeking assistance. We can go back to history and look at the disastrous results of Microsoft's Clippy. So I don't know, yes, some of your listeners are not even going to know who Clippy was, but Clippy was this automatically appearing assistant in Microsoft Word that everyone found annoying. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, Clippy was coded intentionally not to be male or female.
And what moral are you drawing from that?
Whatever you do, don't reintroduce Clippy.
Right. Thank you. To round it off, I'd be very interested to know where you would start. What's the first thing that you would do or have us do to make things better? Sian?
I think we need to look at the lack of women in the development of machine learning and AI. And I think that whilst we see low intakes in computer science courses, this does not mean that there aren't women out there who are more than qualified to be able to hold these roles. And then holding companies to a high ethical standard, you have more women in the field because they are there. We have educated them. We can see the drop off post graduation as well. So we know that we do have the women there to be involved. And if we think about something like Google, which we've used as an example a lot today, 21% of their employees in technical roles are women, but then only 10% are in machine learning and the development of AI. And I think that we have women out there who do have the qualifications. And so we do need to look at the culture of these companies and the culture of the big companies of Silicon Valley and look at ways that women can be encouraged to participate there and the companies can be held to account for when they are exclusionary towards women.
Carissa.
I would invite businesses to create their ethics committees and invite people from all kinds of disciplines, ethicists, lawyers, sociologists, anthropologists, to help them think through the consequences of their creations. And I would invite those ethics committees to think about gender as one of the factors that they take into account when they assess a new algorithm or a new platform or a new website, and to think about whether we want every AI to be gendered or whether there are other alternatives that we should consider.
Thank you, Gina.
I think the era of self-regulation in technology is over. If we look to Facebook, a company that has a billion users in every single country of the globe, we've given a lot of power to a group of people prioritizing their set of values. And that's worked to a certain degree. And now it's time to ensure that we have more transparency and accountability to multiple kinds of stakeholders, not simply shareholders, not simply people within one jurisdiction or one nation state, but that we actually build a kind of regulatory framework that understands that the future of humanity is deeply linked to how our technological systems develop and evolve.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Peter.
My thanks to Gina, Carissa, and Sean for what's been a fascinating discussion, the latest in our first series of Future Makers. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, have a question to ask, or perhaps a suggestion for a future topic, why not leave us a review on the podcast app of your choice? You can also get in touch with us on Twitter at Uni of Oxford. That's all one word. In our next episode, we'll be exploring the birth of AI, looking at the key influences of Ada Lovelace and Alan Turing, and other notable milestones. I'm Peter Milliken, and you've been listening to Future Makers.